Good morning. Before we begin our second case, I'm going to talk a little bit about the timelines that the lawyers on the case know well about and adhere to quite well. We give each side 30 minutes to argue in our attempt to be fair and to treat each side equally. Once in a while, we'll have an oral argument where we may give both sides 45 minutes or an hour, depending on the complexity and the number of issues that are in a case. But today, each side has 30 minutes. Whatever the time amount that the court sets when you get your scheduling order, the lawyers are pretty much uniformly good about complying with those time limits. However, sometimes we're not so good about complying with them, and we've become concerned that one side or the other may feel that they haven't been treated quite fairly, or it may appear to others who are watching this on Wisconsin Eye that the court favors one side or another by asking more questions. So we're going to try very hard today to stick to the red light. When the red light goes on, unless you are answering a then-pending question of a justice, I would ask that you be seated, and I will try to encourage my colleagues to follow the red lights as well. So with that little bit out of the way, we'll call our second case for the day, United Foods and Commercial Workers Union Local 1473 versus Hormel Foods, case number 141880. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you. And may it please the court, my name is Tom Krukowski, and I represent the employer here, Hormel Foods. The issue before the court is really one of, is the donning and doffing involved in this case an issue of integral? Is it integral to the operation of principal activity of employees? Is it indispensable? The issue is not whether we require it. It is not whether there's a benefit to the employer. That's not the issue. What's interesting is this case was certified to this court by the Court of Appeals, or the Fourth District, after it was appealed. After we appealed it, we filed our brief. And they had decided a previous case called Weissman versus Tyson Foods. In the briefing process, what we were able to do is our briefs were filed. The United States Supreme Court on December 9th, 2014, came down with a unanimous decision in the integrity case, which is cited in our brief, and obviously gave pause to the Court of Appeals, for which they said we'd rather not be involved in seeking to modify our case or reversing our case. In this case, and that what they were considering, gives this court another opportunity to review the issues that were presented in the Tyson case and now presented in this court. So I think instructive in terms of the issue that was also certified and accepted by the plaintiff here, the union, in terms of part of it says that even if the employee's task can be performed without the requirement of clothes and equipment, very instructive in terms of we're dealing with whether or not the activities of donning and doffing, whether that activity is in fact integral and indispensable to the work for which the employees perform their principal activity, and the court sitting back and certifying, saying, even if the employees do not have to wear the clothes and equipment to get their job done. The second question is before this court is whether or not, even if we accept the fact that this is integral and indispensable, whether the activities involved in this case are de minimis in terms of whether it's so small, de minimis non curat lex, the law would not concern itself with trivialities.
Are you conceding by not arguing the issue that it is beneficial to the employer?
No, we're not arguing that. We're not waiving that. We're saying that that's an issue that we agree to. We agree that the donning and doffing of this benefits the employer.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Just so it's clear, we also agree that the donning and doffing of this clothing is also required by the employer.
I wasn't clear when I looked at the circuit court judge's opinion. Exactly how Holly Hormel looked.
That's correct.
And there was some description about Holly Hormel, but I wasn't clear. So can you tell me, is it some kind of I know it's whites and blues, right?
Correct.
But is it some, and it can be, according to the judge's opinion and finding of facts and stuff, it can be, I'm now talking about the clothing as opposed to the other gear, it can be worn over clothes, but usually is not. But is it like a jacket, a smock? What are these whites and blues?
It can be. It can be clothing that we put over someone's regular street clothes, or it could be clothing for which they put on. They take off their street clothes and put this clothing on.
Well, so what is it here? I mean, in some ways it does make a little bit of a difference to me. That's why I'm asking the question. Is it a regular collared shirt like you're wearing? Is that a...
It could be, yes.
Well, what is it here in Beloit?
It's exactly both that you described. In terms of, it's either a white shirt and pants, and a belt and shoes. It's a hard hat. It's a hairnet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a earplugs. And it could be that, or it could be someone who's given the clothing, which could be worn over their street clothes. So it's both in terms of the clothing that they wear.
So it's not a set uniform, just different color. Blue for maintenance, they said, and white for others.
Generally, that's correct, but more often, the majority of the people changing their clothes are changing into the whites or blues. They'd be a shirt like I'm wearing and pants that I'd be wearing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the majority of the changing of the clothes.
So you have various kinds of required clothing for different people.
There's a standard. I would venture to say that the evidence in the record shows that Holly Hormel was an example of the pictures of in the record would show that what the people wear. That'd be identified. That's the issue in terms of we take the position that's all clothes changing. Everything you see on Holly is clothes changing, and that's what's the issue in this case.
And it applies to all 330 employees?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So it may be different kinds of uniforms for different employees. Some wear it over the street clothes. Some have to change into them, right? And you have stipulated as to what the median time for each of these is, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
As to day, week, in year.
In terms of the amount of time,
right,
in terms of the donning and doffing, as it was in the record, is 2.904 minutes of donning and doffing before and after.
And you want us to reverse the Weissman case?
That's
Weissman?
Correct.
You want us to...
And the reasoning of it.
Yeah, and the reasoning, right. Because that, if we follow that case, you lose, right?
Correct. If you follow the Supreme Court's unanimous decision integrity, we win. Because we're taking the position.
Well, let's just take one at a time.
Okay.
So our own and a court of appeals decision is published. Is this published?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yes. That's precedential, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's what it says in the rules.
Yes.
Published in the statute book.
That's correct.
Right? Okay. So we have to overrule that.
You have to. Your rule of law in this case would effectively reverse the position in Weissman versus Taylor. We're not. The Weissman versus Taylor case was settled, so therefore the matter was resolved. So the legal issue, however, that you find in Hormel is the same issue that you'd found in Tyson versus Weissman.
Right. So whether we do it on state law grounds or we do it on guidance from the United States Supreme Court from the integrity case, this Court of Appeals case has to be overturned.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, in terms of dealing with the issue at the outset, understand this is a case of first impression that this court has, as it was in the Court of Appeals in terms of the Tyson case. Now, what we take the position is that if the Tyson case had been decided prior if the integrity case had been decided prior to Tyson, Tyson would have come down in favor of the employer here, finding that the donning and doffing was not compensable conduct. And then that'd be the position we take in terms
of... Tell us what the facts were in an integrity case.
Integrity, the employees were basically working at an Amazon.com plant. And they worked there, and they basically collected product and shipped it to Amazon.com people. At the end of the day, they were required to go through an exit screening process, which took up to 25 minutes. So not unlike you'd see in an airport, where someone has to go through to a gate, if you will, and make sure that they're not stealing or taking anything of any value because they had to empty their pockets, not unlike you'd have to do it at an airport. So that's what they were doing in terms of integrity. That's the facts that existed for which the court said, look, when you're analyzing this case, we don't look at whether you require it or whether it benefits the employer, because certainly under the circumstances in the integrity, as was found by the Ninth Circuit, they said because the company required the employees to go through this up to 25 minutes of screening, and because it certainly benefited the employer, and the sole benefit was for the employer to determine whether people were stealing or not. So with those facts, the Supreme Court says, that's the wrong test. You don't use required. You don't use benefit. You use a test that determines whether or not it's integral and indispensable to the job for which the employee is.
So what's the test under integrity?
The test under integrity is whether or not there's evidence to support the fact that what the employee is doing, the activities, are integral, intrinsic to the direct and the productive work for which the employee is performing, number one. And number two, whether or not the work activity, or maybe I should say work, the activity that they're doing is actually indispensable. Now, in analyzing the integrity case, they look at this case from two prongs. They said that's the test that we have to apply. They reversed the Ninth Circuit. They reversed the reasoning of the Court of Appeals here in the Tyson case. Tyson, when they made the decision, relied upon the cornerstone for their case was benefit, required compensation. Supreme Court says, to a unanimous decision, says that's not true. The test is whether it's integral and indispensable. Integral has to be intrinsic to the function of the employee doing the work. And they analyzed that and said, well, in this context, the employees are required or hired to retrieve packages and send them out to Amazon.com customers. They are not hired to go through screening. Furthermore, as the Supreme Court said, again, a unanimous decision. I keep saying that until I have no breath left. But in the unanimous decision, all nine justices said it's not indispensable because what integrity could do in that context is eliminate the screening altogether and it wouldn't affect the employee's ability to perform the job. That's parallel to the case that we have here at Hormel. If you look in terms of the design of this case and the facts in this case, it's clear that in terms of the work that could be done here without the employees donning and doffing. And that was what the district court said was available. Judge Fitzpatrick, the circuit court judge, tried the case in his court, and he said basically that each of the class members agreed that there was nothing essential about the clothes Hormel requires them to wear in order to get their job done. Each agreed that they probably perform each of the movements by their job, even if they're wearing street clothes. So here we're back to integrity again. If you eliminate the screening, could the employees perform their job? Absolutely. If you eliminate the donning and doffing, could the employees perform their job? Absolutely.
Well, they may be able to perform the job, but doesn't Hormel have to make sure that they're performing the job in a safe, sanitary, food-protected way?
Right.
All right, so they have to do something, right?
But that doesn't transition into being integral and indispensable. The company could say, we want you to show up for work in clean clothes. We want you to do things that support the non-contamination of our product, which is a canning process, by the way. It's a food company. Now, in the Supreme Court's integrity decision, they were battling with this issue, although they came out with a unanimous decision. They said, let's see if we can understand this case from our precedent. So they went back to a case called Steiner. In the Steiner case, they said, we will look at something that may not be in terms of conduct or activity that supports a direct function of the job, but because of the circumstance the employees find themselves in this case, lethal, with sulfuric acid, with lead, we find ourselves in that situation that we believe that even though the changing of clothes is not part of the productive process, but because they're in an environment that requires them to change the clothes and shower, because it's lethal, potential for great harm, that they basically have to change the clothes. And the employer in the Steiner case, interesting enough, agreed that the function of changing the clothes was integral and indispensable. The only exception they're trying to say is, did this conduct or this changing of activity was required to be compensated, not whether it was integral and indispensable.
Can you describe for me the facts of IBP, Inc. versus Alvarez?
In the Alvarez case, a little different circumstance in terms of there the employer was a meatpacking process and basically requiring the employees to perform many different functions with different equipment. So it'd be unlike we have at Hormel here in our plant, our canning plant. Our canning plant doesn't require the kill and cut operation that you would find in the other case you're describing. Because that case, the people would wear specific equipment, special equipment that's necessary for the performance of their job. In that context, we'd concede that when you use the steeling and you use the arm guards, the belly guards, and the rest of the stuff, and the aprons that they wear, is very unique and very different that you wouldn't find in the generic stuff that we're talking about here in the Hormel case. That makes the difference. Now,
is it normal to wear a company-supplied uniform in a meatpacking plant?
I would assume it is, yes.
Why?
Just the way companies see themselves as having, a want or a desire to have a uniform policy because it makes it easier for them to see that there's issues of cleanliness, if you will. There's definitely a benefit to a company that does that. We don't deny that. But we're saying that benefit doesn't translate into integral, and certainly not in terms of the Supreme Court's decision integrity, that you have to look at in terms of that process. Let me see if I can't divide these issues the way they should be. What the plaintiff, what Judge Fitzpatrick, and what the Court of Appeals did in the Fourth District is say benefit and requirement. That's the threshold question for all work to be performed. If you suffer employee to do that and work, that's considered to be work and therefore presumed to be compensated. Now, that's one side of it, the presumption of this part of it. So if the employee comes to work early, habitually comes into work half an hour early every day, changes their clothes, has a cup of coffee, talks to their fellow co-employees about what happened on Sunday and the Packers winning their fourth game. They spend a half an hour or more talking about things. Is any of that considered to be compensable? We take position, no. It doesn't relate to the principal activity. It's not integral to the job. It's two steps removed from the principal activity of the employee. And here's why it's two steps removed. Number one, the employee is doing non-productive work, and he's not doing work that he's doing in the work area. And without those, he's two steps removed from doing principal activity or work that he has to be doing in order to be compensated under the regulations that we've outlined here. Now, if we take my position before, let's assume that the employee is working, suffered the work, whatever, presume that it's compensable. Now, we don't stop there. What Judge Fitzpatrick did, what the Court of Appeals did in Tyson, and what the plaintiffs' unions are doing here, they're saying that we don't have to go any farther than that. We just show required a benefit. I just say not. Because now...
Please finish.
Okay, one point. Now, we have 27212E, which says, wait, it may be true benefit in terms of required, but that doesn't stop the equation. That doesn't stop the analysis. You got to take the next part of it. If it's activity that occurs before work and after work, we consider it to be post-preliminary work, and therefore you have to show it's integral and indispensable to the principal activity for which the employee has to perform on a daily basis. Now,
let me ask you a question. When you go to a restaurant and you visit the restroom in the restaurant, you see signs. All employees must wash their hands before returning to work. Okay. Is washing hands integral and indispensable or intrinsic to preparing food in the restaurant?
In the context of integral, in terms of the employee has to be doing something that relates to the function of the job. So let's back up once. Let's say that at the beginning of the day, the employee has to, before they go attend to customers, they're asked to wash their hands. I would take the position that's not integral. That's two steps removed from the principal activity of the employee in terms of wash your hands and come to the workforce with clean hands. That's not integral. That's not indispensable. You want that to happen. You request the employees to do that, but that's not integral to the job. Now, if the employee is doing that, in your example, where the employee during the day is going to the bathroom, basically the employee would be asked to do that. The employee is being paid for the time the employee is going to and from with daily break or whatever the circumstances are. But you got to distinguish between what happened before, because it may be
work. Well, okay, when the employee comes to work at the restaurant, wouldn't you expect them to wash their hands before they start preparing food?
Sure. Could require it even. Benefits the employer, no question about it. But that's not the analysis that integrity talks about in terms of it has to be integral. Now, going back to the Steiner case, and what happens is that because the circumstances were so lethal, any of that washing time, any of the changing clothes time and showering time had to be considered, even though that activity was not added to the productive work, because it was in the circumstance that required it. Now, that's not true of washing your hands. I see the distinction. The Second Circuit in the Gorman case, which was cited in the Weissman versus Tyson case, talks about another hypothetical. They say if you take a diver, and this to me was the best example for what is integral then. You take a diver, goes in the water, he puts a wetsuit on, he puts a mask on, oxygen tanks, he goes into the water to perform his job. The preparatory work does not necessarily help the employer in productive work, but is that employee to be paid for that time of donning that wetsuit and the rest? The answer would be yes, but then the court says in the Second Circuit, the reason why, if he didn't do it, he'd die. He has to do it, not unlike we have in Steiner. Short of that, we're not going to include presumption. We're not going to create the presumption here just because you require it or have benefit. You've got to show it's integral and indispensable to the job. If you can eliminate it, like you eliminated here, we walk in and say, we're not going to have it anymore. We will not have uniforms anymore. We won't do it anymore. Would that change at all the productive work for which employees are going to perform? The answer is no. And that's why I say it is indispensable, and the circuit court found that.
Isn't part of the job making sure you have a sanitary work environment in a food processing plant? It seems to me that it is. You mentioned that's what the parties argue about in part, or advance in part. You mentioned the integrity case here and hang your hat on it. Of course, as you indicate, integrity is a case involving, as I recall, Amazon.com, stockers on the shelves, and the question of whether or not they're going to get compensation standing in line as they are going to punch the clock. The integrity opinion by the United States Supreme Court was a unanimous opinion, but there was a concurrence. And the concurrence, brief as it is, was written, as I recall, to say, okay, let's make sure what we're doing here is clear. And it stated this in clarifying what was on the plate, so to speak, in this case. And the concurrence says that we hold, in this case, that the required security screenings were not integral and indispensable to another principal activity the employees were employed to perform. Again, that's this Amazon.com stocking the shelves and then standing in line to punch the clock. Now this gets to the next sentence. As both Department of Labor regulations and our precedent make clear, an activity is indispensable to another principal activity only when an employee could not dispense with it without impairing his ability to perform the principal activity safely and effectively. Is that the correct test?
Yes.
Okay.
Because
the next sentence then says, thus, although a battery plant worker might, for example, perform the principal activities without donning proper protective gear, he could not do so safely. So the question here is, does the donning of these garments implicate the safety of the principal activity, a sanitary work environment for food processing?
That's not enough, because Justice Sotomayor tried to emphasize here, by using Steiner, that was a toxic, killing environment. And she says, with that understanding, that's what we're talking about safety. There has to be a significant issue regarding some activity.
A sanitary environment, if I recall, last spring, there was a big concern about either your firm or a subsidiary of your firm. I can't remember. It was, I think, in Minneapolis area that dealt with some real concerns about illness emanating from the plants. I mean, so safety and security of the food is always has to be prime in your profession, it would seem to me.
It is in terms of safety, there's no question about it. It benefits the employer. But in order for it to reach that level where the activity of changing the clothes has to be integral, and that is under Steiner, because the changing the clothes didn't add to the productivity, but because the environment was so bad, and because the wetsuit and air tanks were so necessary, that basically they became integral and indispensable by virtue of the environment, not because of safety requirements, because there are no safety requirements here that we're not meeting. We're not required by the FDA, USDA, or OSHA to do anything of the nature we got here. We do.
Why do you have people? Is the reason that you have your employees, even though not required by Fed regs, is the reason you have your employees wear this clothing because you are in part concerned about the sanitation of the work environment?
Correct. We don't deny that. Part of the benefit. But that doesn't take it into the integral arena. That doesn't take us into the issue of indispensability. We could dispense with that, and that's the point of integrity, and therefore there's no compensability. The short time I got left, I want to end on...
Well, I have a question for you.
Okay.
You said, if I heard you right, that the Weissman case relied only on the concept that this was ordered by the company. That's what they wanted and benefited the company. And that's not good anymore under integrity.
Correct.
Well, I went back and looked at my underlinings for Weissman, and if you start at paragraph 28 and you continue on through 37, the court holds, and it relies on the third example of the regulations, right? Do you have any objection to those regulations? You don't challenge them as being invalid. Isn't that right?
Which regulations are you specifically talking about? In terms of the regulations that are from the USDA or FDA or from the regulations of wage and hour laws?
Hey, this is a state case.
I understand.
And we have regulations, and this is the state regulations.
Okay.
And under, I think it's 2E, they have three examples, and the third example deals with a chemical outfit, right?
Yes.
And they rely on that third example on the chemical outfit to show that there's a nexus, a tight nexus, between the donning and doffing and the principal activities of the employees. So they say the concept of closely related is important, and we construe all reasonable inferences in the employee's favor. Donning and doffing at issue here is closely related to the principal activities of the employee. And what's the principal activity of the employee working at this Tyson plant, working with chickens and working with food? And that all this relates to that principal activity of working with the food, and that it be sanitary. And they use, of course, the dictionary definition of dispensable, absolutely necessary. And they say that here you need regulation for sanitary conditions, and that this was such a regulation. And they apply the rules and set forth in the Wisconsin Administrative Code 272.12.2e, and this reads just like the integrity case. They just come to a different result, but they apply the exact same rules that the United States Supreme Court applied integrity. In sum, this is paragraph 37. The donning and doffing of this equipment and clothing at the Tyson plant is required by Tyson for the employees to perform their principal activities. And the donning and doffing of clothing is closely related to the activities and is indispensable to their performance. That sounds like it comes right out of integrity.
It's not without integrity. Basically, says the test is not required of benefit. You have to show integral. That's what they're saying.
This one says. This doesn't say. They say it's for the benefit, but they don't say that's what the test is. They say the test is it integral and.
Integrity does say. Integrity says that specifically that we are not going to use that as our test. They reversed the Ninth Circuit because the Ninth Circuit used that test. Now, to understand your question, Steiner, which everyone relies upon, basically takes the position that, look, when we change your clothes and there's no chemicals involved, that's normal changing, that's not compensable. Our regulations say that. If it's for the convenience of the employee not directly related to the principal activity, it would be considered preliminary or post-preliminary, not compensable.
I know, but here is not for the convenience of the employee. It's for sanitation. Now, if it's not a sanitary requirement, why does Hormel require it?
Because it benefits the employer, to be sure. But it's not integral to the job.
For what?
It doesn't meet the Steiner test. That if you look at Steiner, and Steiner says, look, if you change clothes, And that, well, changing the clothes were basically in normal conditions. You change the uniforms just like you do at Hormel. If that's the case, that's not compensable. They're making the juxtaposed position because the chemicals and the problems you have, your chemicals, made it integral. That's not, they made that juxtaposed position, Snyder, and that's what they said in integrity. And it's all the cases that I'm familiar with say the same thing since integrity.
So your position is that Weissman does not use the integral principal activity test?
They do, but they use the two terms, benefit and requirement, they say is synonymous with the concept of integral and indispensable.
Where do they say that?
They say that in their decision, which you just read it. Yes, you did. You said it. They said they use integral and indispensable. You're saying they use that concept. That concept was suggested based because the company required it, because it benefited the employer for sanitary conditions. That's what it said. But if you read Steiner and the other cases that follow it, if it's normal, it's not compensable. And our regulation 27212E says that.
Thank you, Counselor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Sweet. I represent the workers at Hormel. Waiting in line to egress a warehouse after the end of a work shift is factually and legally different from changing clothes required by an employer where federal regulations to produce that employer's product require that changing. Integrity did not change the federal law on donning and doffing of clothes in food processing plants. Indeed, it referred with approval to another unanimous decision of the United States Supreme Court, IBP versus Alvarez, which held that changing into required clothing and gear was to be considered compensable while waiting in line to do that was not. That was a 2005 United States Supreme Court case with facts very similar to this.
Anytime you wear a uniform?
Pardon me?
Anytime someone's required to wear a uniform, that should be compensable?
No, the judge in the trial court in our case went through a series of factors that showed that it was integral and indispensable to the principal activity that was being performed. So a food plant is the quintessential place where you would not want to stop a person from putting on clean clothes. And we know that from looking at the judge's decision. The trial court went into great detail to find numerous reasons that it was integral and indispensable. There are regulations of the USDA, there are regulations of the FDA. There's benefits to the employer as far as huge customers like Walmart that come to the location and look on a snap basis. They come and look and make sure that it's clean.
Anytime an employer wants an employee to wear a uniform, there will be a benefit to the employer, whether it's just that there's consistency or uniformity or, you know, that they have clean clothing or there are a variety. Maybe it's an issue that they don't want to risk someone wearing unsafe clothing. It just makes it simple sometimes to have a uniform. So when wouldn't it meet that test?
Well, Your Honor, the Department of Workforce Development was charged by the legislature to pass rules and regulations. One of those rules that's been on the books since the late 70s is 272.12E, subsection C. There's three paragraphs. The third paragraph of that subsection deals specifically on weighing the interests of, on the one hand, is it a mere convenience to the employees, and on the other hand, is it integral and indispensable to the employer? Here, the trial court went into great detail about the reasons that it was more on the side of benefiting the employer instead of just a mere convenience to the employees. So that's really the test that the trial court adhered to, and Tyson, the Tyson court at the Court of Appeals also adhered to. But again, uniforms, you're going to have to look at the workplace. And when you look at our workplace, as the judge outlined in great detail, there are other benefits other than just the fact that there are audits by Walmart. There are two OSHA inspectors on the premises at all times at Hormel. This was a finding of the trial court. And the reason they're there is to make sure that the regulations that are under, that the USDA regulations are followed. And there's great reason for that. Hormel realizes that they, on an annual basis, provide training, which is also a requirement, telling employees the grave circumstances of contamination of food. And that turns also to the uniform itself. It is not just a collared shirt. There are 9 clean uniforms at all times presented to the employer by Aramark, So each individual employee has clean uniforms, not shirts and slacks, but uniforms. The trial court found, for example, that there are no pockets on the uniforms. Why are there no pockets? Because the employer does not want to have employees placing things into their pockets and fall into the food. It's for the protection of the public as a safety issue, and it's for the protection of the bottom line of Hormel, which is that they realize that if there are recalls of food or if there's contamination in their food, it ruins the gold standard, which it was testified to, that Hormel does not, you know, they go above and beyond. They are the gold standard in the food industry.
So would it be compensable if instead they required the employees to wear white shirts, black pants of your choosing, but then when you come to the plant, you're going to undergo an inspection?
You can say the last part, I didn't hear you.
Would it be compensable if instead of providing the uniforms, they said, you go buy your own uniform, but when you come here, we're going to have you go through an inspection to make sure it meets safety standards? Would it be compensable then?
Well, I think, again, you'd have to look at all the facts on your hypothetical. So certainly if they allow people to put on the uniforms at home, that would be a different situation. But if the employer is requiring people to place clean uniforms on at the beginning of the shift, again, we're not asking to be compensated for a lot of things. For example, when people swipe into the plant, they walk from where they swipe in to the lunchroom. They go place their lunches into a refrigerator. That's not paid. Then they walk from the lunchroom to the place where they change the clothes, the locker room. That is not paid, and it's not even a question. This time is not compensable under the regulations that were adopted in federal law. It's under the Portal to Portal Act, and this is a critical issue. The reason that the Integrity Staffing case was 9-0 in favor of Integrity Staffing was that it wasn't even a close case, and the reason is because it was a Portal to Portal Act case. If you review the arguments in the case, it had nothing to do with donning and doffing. It had to do with workers egressing the plant at the end of the workday. That's like if we were to come here and say, when we swipe in, we want to get paid from where you swipe in until to walk to the refrigerator. We're not asking for that, and that's why Integrity was not a difficult decision. It left unchanged, and also this is an opportunity for the parties to bring new cases to you. There's not a single donning and doffing case that has been impacted that I've found after Integrity Staffing, and the reason is clear. That case was a Portal to Portal Act case. The Portal to Portal Act was passed in 1947 to reverse the cases that came out after Anderson versus Mount Clemens, and in the federal sector, there was a broad finding of the definition of work. That broad finding still stands to this day. But IBP versus Alvarez in 2005 was a unanimous decision on donning and doffing of the United States Supreme Court. All the Tyson Court did below in the Court of Appeals was look at the requirements of DWD 272.12 E, A through C, and apply that to the facts. And this court, as the trial court pointed out, should be following that analysis of the statute, looking at the plain language first of the DWD regs, and they're not just doing it for their because they want to. They're doing it because they are charged by the legislature to do so. And then there might be a lot of regulations. There are. I mean, if you look at the record.
Before you get into the other regulations, I am wondering, part of your brief was people wanting to leave the workplace for 30 minutes. And in order to do so, they have to take off the clothes that they're required to put on when they go out to lunch and put them back on again when they come in from lunch, correct?
Yes.
Are you asking for compensation for that in addition to the beginning of the workday and the end of the workday for anybody who leaves the place of employment?
Well, the trial court looked at that, and the regulations, again, are clear that if there's not a 30-minute uninterrupted break, it has to be paid for. So the issue is, since people are required to don before they leave the plant and doff before they come when they come back, they're actually getting less than a 30-minute lunch.
Okay, so the answer to my question is yes.
It should be paid for the lunchtime, and the court found that approximately 1% of the workers do that. So we're not asking for pay for the other 99%.
Well, the other 99% may leave tomorrow if they're going to get paid, but that's a question for the future. But you, just so I'm clear, that is what you're asking.
Trial court found, and we believe that the regulations require that finding as long it falls along with the Donning and Doffing being integral.
I have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
They work a 40-hour week. They're not paid for Donning and Doffing. So I assume you're asking for the Donning and Doffing at overtime wages?
We're not, yes. Only employees after the 40 hours is what the trial court is, awarded pay for the employees. So if they only work 35 hours in a week and then they work an extra 20 minutes 1 week because of the Donning and Doffing on 3 days, we're not asking for that pay. It's only after 40 hours. The regulations make clear that you pay time and a half for that work. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
If I ask you the Weissman case, how many other states have law, whether it's court decisions or rules, that are similar to the result in the Weissman?
On a federal level, or you're asking state? I don't know the answer to that question. Other states might adapt different regulations that are more beneficial than the federal regulations, but if they're following the Code of Federal Regulations that came about after the federal cases to broadly define work, and Wisconsin takes that definition directly, it brings in, as Mr. Krakowski said, the workday is the period between the time on any particular workday at which such employee commences their principal activity and the time on any particular workday at which they cease the principal activity. So it points out the workday can be longer than a scheduled shift, hours, tour of duty, or time on the production line. Wisconsin simply adopted these regulations, and they've been there since the late 70s in Wisconsin. I don't know the other states, but if they adopted the federal regulation language, which we did, I mean, we did not adopt the Portal to Portal Act. That's important to note. And that's why our case at Hormel does not fall or rise on the same as the integrity standard, because the integrity standard dealt with the egressing of employees. When you're leaving the plant, that's quintessential Portal to Portal Act uncompensated time. Hormel employees are asking for the opposite. They're asking for Donning and Doffing when there is indeed this tight nexus between the federal regulations and food plant.
Let me ask this. Does this case involve just the Beloit plant or all four plants in Wisconsin?
Just the Beloit plant, Your Honor.
Okay. There are 39 plants, plants somewhat similar to this one in the Hormel system. How many of those plants compensate people for Donning and Doffing?
I don't know the answer to that question. The issue is only at the Beloit plant. I know that they are not compensated, and the court, the trial court below, found that that is in violation of the state regulations and applied the Tyson standard.
Can you think of any unintended? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Didn't you used to be able? Were you not compensated? Your workers compensated in the past?
Yes, part of the record shows that in the late 70s or early 80s and before, there was compensation for Donning and Doffing.
Under a collective bargaining agreement?
Yes.
And why doesn't that exist anymore?
The record doesn't show exactly why, but it came about through the process of the employer taking that back during bargaining, that they received the benefit of not having workers paid.
Why haven't either counsel discussed at any length the Sandifer case?
Which case?
Sandifer case.
Yeah, the Sandifer case we did brief, Your Honor. And, in fact, the Sandifer case, I mean, the judge cited, the trial court talked about it as well, but the main purpose that I've reviewed the Sandifer case was the United States Supreme Court's notification or from Justice Scalia saying that we're talking about trifles here. Isn't the Fair Labor Standards Act all about trifles? So the existence of a de minimis defense for the employer, which they've raised to this court and this court is considering as well, is also not, it's at least questioned by Justice Scalia. And we would state that the process that the trial court went through to apply the federal law was well reasoned. You'd look at the how often it happens. This happens every single day. Employees every single day are putting on the required uniforms that are waiting for them in the locker room. They are washing their hands. They're putting on the personal protective equipment. They're walking from there to their work location, and then they're doing the reverse on the way out. It's during the continuous workday as well. The standard is that anything, even a small trifle, would be compensated so long as it's after the first principal activity. And the Sandifer's case points out that at least Justice Scalia questions whether the Fair Labor Standards Act in modern times makes sense to take away a person's pay, even if it is a small amount, because we're talking all about trifles. So the court below in Sandifer was on all fours with ours as far as donning and doffing, but those cases are a dime a dozen, as I told you. The integrity, the employer wants you to believe that integrity staffing was an earthquake in federal law with regard to donning and doffing, and it's just not true. This court would be the very first that I know of to apply integrity staffing, which is a Portal to Portal Act case, to a donning and doffing case. The donning and doffing is clear in the federal regulations. It was adopted in part by the state of Wisconsin, and it's required.
Well, the federal law talks about de minimis, but the state law does not. Is that right?
That's also true. The whole idea of de minimis, you would have to be, I mean, the trial court judge looked to the federal law because it was helpful, but this court has not found de minimis, and it does not exist in our regulations.
And trial court did an aggregate, you know, maybe 5 minutes per day is not much, but when you add it up over the year, it's 24 hours, and that's money.
About $500 per worker, and they're earning per year, $500 for workers earning, you know, $25,000 to $40,000 at the most.
That's,
it might not be a lot for some workers that are making a huge amount of money, but it's certainly not a trifle, and because it's required every single day.
It's not a trifle to Hormel either, because it has 330 employees, and you multiply 24 hours by them, that's a lot of money. Now, you keep emphasizing, and I can understand why, that integrity is a portal-to-portal case, and I agree with that. But in interpreting the Portal-to-Portal Act, very similar words are used there that are used here in the Donning and Doffing cases, namely, principal activities that are an integral and indispensable part of the employee's work. And they use that as the standard. And when I read it, I said, whoa, sounds like the very standard that was used in Weissman. Sounds like the standard that's used in the examples of these state regulations. And so what you have to do is see what the principal activity is. And the principal activity in integrity was not going through a security check. Security check had nothing to do with the actual work of the employees, right?
Right, and you could do it safely without. It's the egress test, even if you were to put aside the fact that it's a quintessential Portal to Portal Act activity and it's separate from donning and doffing, still you can perform the work of an Amazon worker without going through the check. You cannot, for one day, perform work at Hormel's plant without having the USDA regulations followed, and Hormel has required employees.
Does the USDA regulation require particular uniforms?
No, they do not, but they have general rules, and that's interesting because the Steiner case from 1956 that was cited with approval, if you look at the facts in the underlying court case before the Supreme Court, there was a Tennessee statute in 1950 that was a statute of general applicability that dealt with employees showering, not if it's going to kill you not to, but just if it's in your best interest, a general rule like the USDA regulations that require clean uniforms in a food processing plant. And that rule was also upheld in Steiner. So it's not simply if you're going to die without doing the work, that's not the test. And very few courts have said that you should make a distinction between whether the worker is going to die without it versus, like, there was testimony from the trial court that was credited from one of the lead plaintiffs, Pam Collins, that she might get splashed, and she would get splashed in the face without the safety glasses that are provided. So there are safety benefits, and to draw lines line between getting maimed and getting killed seems to be an odd place for a court to draw a distinction about compensability. What you look for is whether it's integral and indispensable to the work. And integral is from the word integer, meaning of a whole. So the whole activity, and there can be more than one principal activity. That's also clear from the case law. And any activity that is that is integral and indispensable to the principal activity is itself a principal activity, which is why the donning and doffing here is a principal activity. It's integral and indispensable. The court went through again, you know, not just the USDA regulations, but also the fact that Hormel has rules. If employees don't put on the required clothing, not just is it integral and indispensable to the employer, but also employees would be terminated if they don't. This is capital punishment in the realm of labor relations. You lose your job if you don't follow Hormel's rules. Hormel doesn't allow you to take the clothes home at the end of the day. They require you to throw them in a bin at the end of the day to make sure that you can get clean clothes the next morning when you get there. They have Aramark coming three times a week to deliver clean clothes. All of these things also benefit Hormel. They find that it's cost efficient, the court did as well. There was testimony from the trial about the fact that wearing the whites and the professional protective gear is also cost efficient for the employer because they know that everyone is putting it on. They don't have to have supervisors looking at one employee's clothes and the other. They know that every single person gets a fresh, clean pair of clothes, uniforms, every morning.
I would like to follow up on a question that was asked earlier that's of concern to me and maybe apparently of concern to other members of the court. I'm focusing on the lunch hour, the 30 minutes. Our opinions and our have to make sense. We struggle mightily for that goal. This doesn't make sense to me. If we would agree with the trial court that the donning and doffing for some employees who do this over the 30-minute lunch hour should be compensable, what doesn't that provide an incentive for, as the questioner indicated, you know, more, maybe all, of the employees to say, oh, let's get time and a half. Let's put on and take off over the 30-minute lunch hour. That doesn't make sense to me. It sounds like it will be giving a rather perverse incentive. Now, so, tell me why it does make sense. Tell me why, since it only affects a few, according to the record, a few employees, that shouldn't be considered de minimis. So you've got two questions there.
Well, again, it's only if you're, just factually, it's only if you're leaving the plant that you're entitled to that pay.
Yes, as long as you step outside the front door, having doffed and donned, you can do it. And I don't mean to
but yes,
I just want to, I don't mean to suggest ill motives, but I want to test the extremes of your argument to see if it's rational.
I think the exact same test is being applied. So if you find that donning and doffing the clothes is compensable in the morning and in the afternoon where employers are required because it is integral and indispensable, the exact same argument makes exact same sense because of the regulation that requires a bona fide meal period of 30 minutes. So Hormel would be required to allow employees to take a full 30-minute lunch, which includes being able to don first, then leave the plant, then come back 30 minutes later, and then or doff first, and then don on the way back in.
So you're not really responding to my concern about the potential for gaming the law.
I don't see how it's gaming because the legislature has said that the Department of Workforce Development has to pass these regulations, and they have. They've said that everyone's entitled to a 30-minute bona fide meal period.
Why? And my second part of the question went to the whole discussion we've just been having regarding de minimis. Why shouldn't that be considered de minimis? Is there any rationale for that being de minimis and the beginning and end of workday not being de minimis?
Again, you're looking at the whole under the Lindau test, so you're looking at the practical difficulty of recording the additional time. There is none. Hormel did track the time we stipulated in the trial court. The aggregate amount of time, of compensable time, again, that's the amount. It's not the 2.9 minutes that Mr. Krakowski referenced. It's the aggregate amount. It's every single day that an employee comes on. It's 5.7 minutes a day. It's 25 hours a year. It's $500 per worker per year. That's the test under the federal law. You look at the regularity of the additional work, which, as I said, and the amount of daily time spent on the additional work. So the fact that you're required, if you want to get the state-mandated 30-minute bona fide lunch period, just adds to the aggregate amount.
So the 5.7 minutes include the initial putting them on and the final taking them off and the lunch hour, donning and doffing?
No.
So it only deals with putting them on to begin with and taking them off, right?
Right.
But the trial court order says that the rights of the parties are, this is B, 2B, that the class members have been denied the right to 30 minutes off duty to allow the premises. And the doffing and donning clothes and gear during such 30 minutes violates the class members. Declaratory judgment is that's a violation.
Right. We had made it, yes.
Then number three says the class is awarded monetary damages of $195,000. How is that calculated?
That includes the $15,000, which is 1% of the $1.5 million.
So that's included in this?
Yes.
It's not included in the 5.8, but there's an extra 15 grand.
Yes.
I understand that. I have another question for you. Do you support the Weissman opinion? And if you don't, where don't you support it?
Well, the Weissman opinion simply follows the DWD regulation, so it's not whether I support it. It's whether the legislature required the Department of Workforce Development.
You don't think it goofed in any way? Now, the Mel takes the position that it violates integrity.
Like I said, it has nothing to do with integrity. Integrity was a Portal Act decision with an egress of workers at the end of the workday, and this is not.
But it uses the same test of principal activity and integral part.
Yeah, but even integrity leaves intact, and it cites to Steiner and IBP versus Alvarez and the entire line of federal donning and doffing decisions. And like I said, to my knowledge, maybe he'll correct me when he stands back up, but there's not a single case that applies integrity to donning and doffing. And the reason is because there's a plethora of federal case law, and there's Code of Federal Regulations, and Wisconsin has picked up on the key ones that says that we have to look at integral and indispensable, which means the nature of the work compared to a mere convenience. If it was a mere convenience for the employees to place a polo shirt on instead of a red shirt, that's not compensated. But here, the trial court has found, and this court should only reverse those findings of fact if they are clearly erroneous, a number of facts that show that it is directly relevant, and it's there's a tight nexus between the employees doing the donning and doffing and wearing the protective activity and gear and the employer's business, and it couldn't be any more clear than a food plant, like I said.
If the outfit took a minute to put on and a minute to take off, would you be making the same argument?
Well, if you put it on after the principal activity, or if that is the principal activity, then it's paid regardless of how long it takes. That's the continuous workday rule, which is part of DWD regulations. It says that yes, it would be compensable as long as the donning and doffing is compensable, which requires you to look at the nature of the work.
So is there ever a time when putting a uniform on or off, is there ever a time that it's not compensable?
It would depend on the facts, but certainly it's not with the factual record we have, which is what I'm describing to you. But, yes, I guess there probably could be a place where employees are not required to keep food uncontaminated by USDA.
What if they just had them zip into a suit and it took 30 seconds to zip into it?
That's not what Hormel has decided to do. They have a clear regiment to meet this gold standard that the plant manager testified to. And so Hormel doesn't want to be zipped up and just throw people out on the into the workplace. They want people to go through a very exact process. And why? It's because it allows them to comply with the regulations. And there are a lot of them, you know, in the food industry for good reason.
Well, you haven't said it specifically that I heard, so let me ask it. I think it's your position that these regulations as to what should be worn, including the nets and the whether it's over the clothes or under the or in place of the clothes, they all relate to sanitation. That's the whole purpose of these rules for Hormel, and that's why it's related to the principal activity of the workers, which is working in a plant that deals with food, and that it's required to be sanitary, and that this is a rule dedicated towards that. Whether you agree with it or not, that's the purpose of the rule. That's why Hormel has it. And therefore, it's integral and indispensable to the principal activity of the employee.
Yes, that's a big part of it, is the regulated nature of the food industry. But there were more, according to the trial court. You look at the benefit to its customers. Customers come in and see that it's a very clean and orderly plant. One person's not wearing white and another person's wearing purple. I see my red light is on.
But Hormel says the benefit to the employer is not the test. And that the fact that it's an employer requirement is not the test. And I think the integrity case says that, and I think you'll find that in other cases, that you got to have more than, oh, it's just ordered by the company.
Right. You would have to look at the nature of the work as well.
That's right. So it's unimportant whether it's ordered or whether it benefits the company, unless the benefit is for the sanitation. The sanitary aspect, which is an integral part of the workforce.
That is certainly a unique portion of our case. Yes, Jan? Thank you.
Integrity does deal with the regulations that we're talking about here. Matter of fact, the unanimous decision cites the 29 CFR 70. 790.8, and they talk about the issues of principal activity. They were relying upon the federal regulations that mirror the state regulations. If you look at our page 28 of our brief, we have both sections there. The court does rely upon the federal regulations, and we're relying upon the regulations here that's promulgated by the DWD. So from that point of view, we have to listen to that and look at that, because going back to the cornerstone of the case of the union, the cornerstone of Tyson, and the cornerstone of these cases all deal with, because you require it, because it benefits, is compensable. And I'm saying no. When it's pre-work, post-work, then it has to be integral and dispensable, and the court again has instructed us with the safety issue. I think Justice Rose before, safety and efficiency. Now, when they dealt with efficiency issues, they went back to an earlier case, decided the same day as Steiner, and said, look, if an employee who comes to work is a meat cutter, he's got to sharpen his knife. Basically, that sharpening the knife is productive activity, therefore it's integral and indispensable to his function. But short of that, that doesn't exist. And that's what Sotomayor did in her concurring opinion, saying the same thing. Short of that, we do not have...
Counsel, how do you propose that we tease out what seems to be the underlying motivation of the employer here, which is to ensure that the conditions within the plant are not only sanitary, but demonstrably so, to even the unlearned observer. So, if we can all agree that good hygiene and good sanitation are prerequisites to anyone in the food industry, anyone working in the food industry, coming in direct contact with the food, how do you propose that we tease that essential function of the job, which is to maintain hygiene and sanitation, from the essential function or the essential work of the employee?
Because we talk about indispensability. If you sit back and say, as a judge found, as a testimony, and is uncontradicted, said, I could come to work with my street clothes on and perform the same job I had before. You'd have to obviously monitor the dress that you dressed, the way I dressed. It has to be sanitary conditions. But that doesn't in of itself make it integral. The clothing is the issue we're talking about. Let me use integrity as a further example. In integrity, there's no question that the sole benefit was to the employer. The employer was concerned about stealing and said, if you're going to stand in line up to 25 minutes to go through a test, who does it benefit? Obviously, the employer wants concerned about shortages, wants concerned about profit, wants concerned about theft of what product that they have access to, but for which the court says that's not indispensable. You can eliminate it. That's not integral because that's not part of their job. You don't say, if I work at Hormel, I work at Hormel, do what? I'm a canning operator. I don't say I change clothes. That's not my job. I don't perform the job in that context. So when it comes to your question in terms of how do we work our way from the sanitation, we do, based on the integrity decision, we also look back at the teaching of Steiner. When Steiner says, if you're going to expose employees to that condition, then you're going to pay. Now, if the Supreme Court said at the same time, look, if you've got to go in and change clothes and wash up under normal conditions, that's not compensable. That may be an issue that we have here in terms of this. I think the Supreme Court speaking to that and saying, if Hormel wants you to wear a white shirt, that's what they want to wear, they wear a white shirt, black pants, I can tell the employees, okay, fine, I'll negotiate with the union. From now on, you're going to buy your own shirts, white, pink, green, or whatever they are. I want you to come to work, and I'm going to inspect you as you come in the door.
Now, Mr. Sweet argued, part of his argument was that if the employer were to do that, it would have to pay out more wages in terms of supervisors to enforce that. And that's where you would run back, I assume, to the argument which you made at the beginning of this hearing, which was just because it's a benefit to the employer, in this case, we are not incurring the additional expense of the additional supervisors. We acknowledge that's a benefit, but that doesn't change the fact that this is within integrity. I think I follow. Yes. Do I follow your argument?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Let me shift to the little time I got left in terms of the minimus you talked about. It's interesting, they cite the Lindau case in their brief. That case, however, stands for a proposition, it is de minimis. And they say that the employees were doing something that took between 7 and 8 minutes, more than the minute or two that you're talking about. Court says that's de minimis. They also had another condition there in terms of it has to be administratively difficult. What the plaintiffs in the union has done here, they said the mechanism today is much better. It's not the mechanism. It's the herding of cats, the people that come to the work and basically get the work done. That's the issue of administrative difficulties establishing this. We are down to 2 minutes and 9.9.04. Judge Posner in his decision says, look, we should stop this because what's doing is flooding the courts in terms of we're getting these arguments about integral, indispensable, how much time. Judge Posner in this case actually went to his law clerks, went out and bought clothes and had them changed and he time stopped them. In the appellate process, not a fact finder, he said, I find it to be 2 minutes. Also instructive, if you read, and that was an interesting dilemma that he had to some of the justices. But go back to the integrity decision in the Ninth Circuit. You know what it was? They had the same thing we're talking about here with the lunch period. Guess what? The employees had to go through a screening process so they weren't stealing things and going into the lunchroom. It only took 5 minutes. What the court said? De minimis. We're not going to charge the employer with that conduct, with that activity, because it's not part of their job. Even the Ninth Circuit said that when it got to the Supreme Court, Thomas is an unanimous decision. He instructed, he said, look, you got a problem with this 25 minutes? Go back to the bargaining table. Don't bring lawsuits here. Don't bring lawsuits in terms of what's integral, indispensable, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 1 minute, all the rest of stuff. Those are things left for the bargaining table. That's where it should start. That's where it should end. The question that you asked before in terms of were they paid? Yes, they were. We cannot find the negotiators alive today who were involved in the early 80s when this thing was changed. It could have been that they continued to pay. They were paying 6 minutes a day or whatever the circumstances were. But you got to realize it's not 5 minutes. It's 2 minutes.
Thank you, counsel. Your red light is on. I thank you both for very spirited arguments. And I understand when you get going in an argument, you're not looking at the red light. And I certainly understand that. I stood in your place for years before I sat over here. So I certainly understand that. I appreciate both of your briefs and the very excellent arguments that you presented here today. I thank you very much. And we are now adjourned until 1:30 when we will pick up our third case for the day.